Locked On Red Sox, your daily Boston Red Sox podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome back to Locked On Red Sox on the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. As always, I'm your host, Gabrielle, founder of Girl at the Game, and I've got two episodes for you today because there was so much to talk about with Cora and the Red Sox that you get two. Today's episode, part one, I have my friend and mentor, Steve Buckley, longtime Boston sports journalist, now senior writer at The Athletic, on the show. And then part two is the second half of my conversation with Ethan, host of Locked On Pirates, talking about the three manager hirings. Before I play this conversation that I had with Buck, I want to congratulate Red Sox infielder Michael Chavis on his engagement to his longtime girlfriend and high school sweetheart. Unsurprisingly, the guy who tweets at 11:11 every single night got engaged yesterday on November 11th. So congratulations to the happy couple. All right. So today on Locked On Red Sox, we have Steve Buckley, legendary Boston writer, formerly of the Boston Herald, now of The Athletic. I've known Buck for almost 4 years now. I've been reading your writing for a lot longer than that. I'm honored to call you a friend, and thank you for being my guest.
You know how much I love gabbing with you. This is not work for me.
It's not work for me either. So I wanted to talk this week because tomorrow is actually the one-year anniversary of the Astros scandal, like, officially breaking. We have Cora back as of earlier this week, Hinch is with the Tigers, and you've been around the game for a long time. It's one of your long-running jokes on Twitter is that you've been here since, you know, the Boston Americans in 1903. What's your take on Cora coming back?
Well, first of all, it wasn't a joke. I was here in the Boston American.
You've always been here.
Yeah, I've always been here. So vis-a-vis Cora, I am not certainly in any way morally outraged. So we can cast that aside right away. I did write a week ago that I thought it would be a complicated situation because, as we all know, the unveiling of a new manager or coach is supposed to be a happy celebratory occasion. The guy, you know, I wrote this, he puts on the new shirt and, you know, he says all the right things and my office door is always going to be open and all the beat writers get him alone and try to build a relationship. It's a nice little game. It's been going on for 1,000 years. This is a little different because, I mean, let's be honest, half of the press conference the other day had to do with cheating. There's no getting around that. You know, I don't know what the situation will be next season in terms of fans in the stands. Manfred has said most recently yesterday, he anticipates, you know, fans being in the stands next year, but not packed houses. But, you know, they go into Yankee Stadium, people are going to be banging on trash barrels and, you know, things like that. And that's going to be part of the narrative for next year. So I wrote that it's complicated. So my shorter answer is I do give him credit for owning it and taking responsibility and not falling on that. If I offended anybody, I apologize. No, he apologized. I'm not really sure what he's apologizing for. He doesn't really want to get into the specifics. He was a little vague about that, but I think he's off to a good start.
Yeah. I mean, I think you and I are very much on the same page in that respect. He went through the investigations. However thorough or correct the Major League Baseball investigations and their findings were, isn't really about him. That part's on Major League Baseball to decide what they're going to do. He served the suspension that he got. So, you know, technically, Hinch and Cora were free to be hired, so teams hired them. But it did feel weird, you know, kind of watching them recreate the photos of him walking over the David Ortiz Bridge, you know, recreating them, putting on the manager jersey, because it kind of felt like a Twilight Zone of 2017. You know, we've been here before. We already did the walk over the bridge picture. Like, everything on social media just feels a little bit, I don't think obnoxious is the right word, but all of the posts that they've been putting out, like my manager, my this, it kind of feels tone deaf of like, okay, he's here. Let's kind of just like let the dust settle a little bit.
As far as the walking over the bridge thing, I was nonplussed by it. Is that the right word? I wasn't into that, nor was I offended by it. I just kind of gave it a shrug.
Unfazed.
I was unfazed. Somebody in marketing came up with that. I hope it was an intern because it was just kind of cheesy. And if they're slapping their back in the offices about that, then, you know, I might suggest they aim a little higher next time because I just thought it was like, oh, really? Are we going to do this? Okay, go ahead. And I chose just to ignore it. My other big takeaway from the press conference, and I asked the question, you know, what's going to happen? You know, they've got Haim Bloom here now, and the Sox have all been about analytics for a long time now when Haim was in junior high school. So he didn't invent it, but he certainly takes it to the moon and back. He's from the Tampa Bay Rays, and, you know, I used the term morally outraged a little while ago, and I'm not when it comes to Cora being manager. I was morally outraged when Kevin Cash snuck out of that World Series game in game
yes.
six. And he was killing.
He'd only thrown seven free pitches.
Yeah, no, it was dumb. It was stupid. It denied fans of a former Cy Young Award winner facing a former MVP and Mookie Betts. It was wrong on so many levels. And Haim and Alex, you know, fell over each other seeing who could say the nicest things about Cashy. Look, I love Kevin Cash.
Yeah.
I've known him for years. He's a great guy. I remember when he was a scout. So I've known him for a while. But it was wrong. It was stupid. It was dumb. And I get a kick out of these people saying hindsight's 2020. I can produce witnesses that I was screaming at the time it was happening in real time. And Joe Buck, the announcer, it was Smoltz. They were first guessing it when it happened. So don't give me the hindsight nonsense. Alex made a point about Eddie Rodriguez in the World Series against the Dodgers, and the metrics said that this was a good matchup against Puig, and of course it didn't work out. Puig got a home run. And I think what Alex was saying, that he owns that he should have taken him out of the game. So what I'm hoping is that there are occasions, listen, they all fall back in that dumb thing where they say, oh, it's nothing's changed in 100 years. You get all the information, you go in as prepared as possible and act accordingly. Now, that's not entirely true. Yes, they would give, you know, back in the 60s, they throw a scouting report at the manager's desk. But once the game started, the manager managed with his eyes and his belly and the information that it provided for him. What I'm afraid of is I'm all for analytics. I'm all for being the best prepared kids in the class. Fantastic. You'll go to a better college. You'll get a good job. You'll buy a nice house. That's what we all want for my kids. That's what we all want for our major league teams. But if the manager sees something that isn't reflected in those reports, let's just say hypothetically your starting pitcher comes into the game. He has the flu. Maybe he went out in the town last night and he's feeling a little queasy. I'll be vague about that. But none of that is going to be reflected in whatever reams of data you have at your disposal before the game starts.
Babe Ruth showing up hungover.
That's what you said. I'm saying maybe you went out a little late, you came in a little queasy. And if you're the manager, you need to act on information that might not be statistical, that might not, some things that happened. Maybe stubbed his toe getting out of the shower. Oh, Skip, I stubbed my toe. You're the manager in the game, and he's not coming off the mound just the way you thought. Or in the case of Snell in Game 6, he was dealing great. Two hits, nine strikeouts, 73 pitches, and you don't touch him. Leave. I don't want to hear this third time around the batting order nonsense. That was wrong. It was bad for baseball. Good that the Tampa Bay's lost. You've never won a championship. The Dodgers have won their first since 1988, and that's good because their manager screwed up, and I can't say enough nice things about Kevin Cash. I'm talking specifically about that move, and it was the wrong move.
I met him on opening day 2018, and he was super nice, but, I mean, yeah, it kind of makes me think of, like, you know, self-driving car technology. You know, they have like the Teslas and everything that, you know, they can drive themselves on the highway. They can start and stop. They can change lanes. They can do all these things. But at the end of the day, they still can't predict everything that's going to happen. So a human person needs to be awake and upright in the driver's seat to anticipate something unexpected. And I think that's kind of the perfect analogy for analytics in baseball, that, you know, they can be super helpful, but they can't predict the future to the fullest extent. They can't anticipate the unexpected. You still have to have a manager who at the end of the day is going to be confident enough to make their own decisions based on what is actually happening in front of them. And whether or not the decision plays out in your favor, not just be like, well, the numbers indicated this. If you want to hire analytics, then just put a computer in the dugout.
Let me go back to the Tesla, the self-driving car. Are you saying that when I get my self-driving car, I just can't sit in the back seat and read my athletic downloads or some Netflix original series and have a nice cup of coffee? I can't do that with my self-driving car.
So I don't know if you actually know this about me, but my first job out of college was working in sales and marketing at Tesla. So I used to drive one of those bad boys every single day, which was awesome. But the way that at the time their autopilot, which was and I think still is the most advanced autopilot technology on the market, the way that their autopilot worked was it had a lot of safety protocols built in, not to get too much into specifics, but basically a person had to sit in the driver's seat. The autopilot only worked on the highway, and every, 30 seconds or so, the car would beep to tell you to just gently place your hands on the wheel to make sure that you were still like awake and focused. And if you didn't do that, it would beep louder. And if you still didn't respond, the car would pull over to the side of the road and turn off completely. What they understand is that even now, technology in any form is not able to have the instincts in an unexpected situation than a human person can. They have autopilot. They have one of the most advanced autopilot systems in the car industry. The same way the Rays have some of the biggest analytics focus in baseball. But at the end of the day, your driver still needs to be able to drive the car, and your manager still needs to be able to make executive decisions. That's why they're your manager.
I agree 100%. And I hope that in 2021 that Alex Cora, and I don't know, sometimes we won't know the situation. Sometimes he will make a move that's contrary to their analytics, and we may not even pick up on it because it might be something small. I just hope that when it's something big, a la Blake Snell in the World Series, that he isn't held prisoner to the reams of data thrown into his lap. Let's put it that way.
I don't know how much Chaim Bloom has said this in media pressers, but this was kind of random. But he did a Q&A for the Jewish community in Boston, and it was like no media allowed, but my family watched it. He was talking about like the kind of relationship that he wanted with his manager. This was obviously like a month ago before, they had started talking to Cora and everything. He was just saying he really wanted a true partnership. He wanted someone that he could really have a rapport with, have trust with, have a very collaborative union between a GM and a field manager. Do you think that Dave Dombrowski and Cora, from what you saw, had that kind of relationship? Or do you think that Cora is now entering a very different, I personally think, I don't think Chaim Bloom and Dave Dombrowski, they could not be more different from each other. That's why Chaim Bloom is here. But do you think that this is going to be a fruitful partnership for Cora and Bloom?
Well, I think that Dombrowski and Cora had a very good relationship, as evidenced by the fact, and this came out when Cora met with the beat writers after the press conference, and I think Jen McCaffrey from The Athletic wrote about it, that Cora received like a weekly phone call from Dombrowski the entire year that Cora was on his suspension. And you can call somebody once, maybe twice, but if you're calling somebody every single week to say, hey, how you doing? Stick in there, big boy. That suggests a good relationship. So I'm guessing they had a very good relationship. Moving forward with Alex Cora, the only thing I can say about that is that he can't use the World Series of 18 as currency. He could have used it last year, and probably did. We did use it last year, as evidenced by the fact that they were still celebrating the World Series in spring training, if you may remember. I'm talking about 19. The World Series isn't currency anymore. The guy had a year-long suspension, and now he's back for a new head of baseball ops. So you can't do a lot of swaggering. You've got to make your bones all over again. So it's a story yet to be written. So I would just be guessing. And if that's what you want me to do, I would say, let me see how good the team is first, because they have no starting pitching, and it's not a really good team right now. And
no.
I kind of like to get an idea what the team looks like first, because if they're in a rebuild in 21, I would imagine that Cora is going to just, you know, save his bullets for another day and not defy analytics and just sort of let it play out and build the team for the next season.
Yeah, I think more what I was asking in terms of Dombrowski, I think they had a good relationship like on a human level. But in terms of like how collaborative they were, I don't know. It just feels like Chaim Bloom wants to be more involved kind of on like the field level, I think, from what he said, than like Dombrowski and Cora, I think, got along really well and they had a good working relationship. But I think Chaim Bloom kind of wants to get his hands a little dirtier than Dombrowski did.
And he will, in the sense that their analytics department is going to be spitting out the optimum lineup in view of the analytics for the opposing team and suggested moves will be made by analytics that this is the best way to beat the Royals, Twins, Indians, who's ever across the field. That's the department that Chaim Bloom will be heading up as part of his overall sphere of influence in baseball. I don't think that we're in an era where the general manager just puts the team together. I mean, if you ever read like Leo DeRocher, Nice Guys Finish Last, which was ghosted by Ed Lynn back in, I think, the early 70s. And I knew Ed very well. He told me about that book that he wrote. And Leo DeRocher, who was a Hall of Fame manager with the Brooklyn Dodgers, New York Giants, and then later the Cubs and Astros.
Leo the Lip.
Leo the Lip. Very good.
And Leo, I'm almost as old as you.
and Leo would talk about how the manager came into the clubhouse twice a season before opening day, on opening day, you know, let's go boys, let's win, you know, so forth. And then he'd come in the last day of the season. That's how it was done back in the day. And I'm certainly not suggesting we go back to those days, because even Lou Gorman 30 years ago was in the clubhouse before and after every game. So I'm not suggesting we go back to those days, but I would dare say that in terms of day-to-day involvement in in-game activities, and I'm just guessing this based on what I've read and heard and seen and so forth, that Chaim Bloom will have a lot more to say about the lineup and in-game moves. I'm not saying he's going to be calling down the dugout the fourth inning and say, take this guy. I'm not saying that. But there will be, even though Cora says there won't be a script, there will be. And it's up to the manager to know when and how to deviate from that script.
I think it's going to be really interesting. And that's the third facet, I feel like, of how different this year is from 2017 when he came in, because Dombrowski kind of had a stacked deck for him, just like waiting, you know, and it was kind of not hard to see why Cora became the third first-year manager for the Red Sox in the last 15 years to win a World Series in their first season with the club. But I think it'll be interesting to see what he does now when he's coming into pretty much like a decimated roster.
Yeah, I'm not going to try and climb inside Alex Cora's head and think his thoughts. However, as I wrote in The Athletic the other day, this is a guy that has been around clubhouses since he was a toddler. His father was involved in media in Puerto Rico when he was 9, 10 years old, even younger. He was in the clubhouses, Puerto Rican Winter League. His big brother Joe, he's 11 years older than him, so he was hanging around ballplayers. So he's got the game deep in his belly. And if I had that background in baseball, I can only speak for myself. Would I embrace analytics? Yes. Would I read all that stuff and try to be better prepared? Yes, because that's what smart baseball people do. Information is gold, and you try to use it to the best of your abilities. However, as a baseball lifer, if it were me, I would be saying to myself, once this game starts, I will use that information right up to the point where I don't need the information or I don't want the information. And I think that there's a part of Alex Cora let me take it beyond Alex Cora. I think that deep down inside, even the most analytics-driven managers, I think a part of all of them wishes they could be Leo DeRocher and Joe McCarthy and Casey Stengel and have the freedom, because it's going to be fun, man. Like, manage by your gut, and like I saw something, and the way he twitched his eye, I don't know. I mean, and that's part of what being a manager is. And I think deep down, a lot of today's managers, even the ones who love analytics, kind of have a longing for those days. And I'll just say it that way.
Yeah, All right. One last topic. It's probably more than one question, but one topic. Whether or not fans are in the stands in full capacity next year, in partial capacity at Fenway Park, it's been a hard 12 months or so, even longer, to be, you know, a Red Sox fan. And I'm not, you know, there are teams like the Indians who haven't won since 1948. I'm not talking about championships, but just in terms of losing Mookie Betts, losing Cora, the cheating investigation, then the really frustrating season, just so much upheaval in Boston. It's been like a hard year to be a Red Sox fan. I'm curious what you think, if anything, the franchise is going to do to kind of bring fans back into the fold. You know, a lot of people said after Mookie Betts, like, I'm done. A lot of people said after Cora, I'm done. Obviously, the team's going to make a ton of money either way, but do you think they're going to make any effort at all to kind of do anything for Red Sox Nation? I mean, like, last winter, they announced that they were planning on raising ticket prices for 2020.
I know where you're going with this. Let me just cut you off the test. Do I think they will make an effort to make the game more fun and usable? But yes, of course, they're smart people. And they do have a marketing department, and they want to grow their fan base. So the answer is yes, they will make the effort. The problem is there's two different things at hand. There's the business side. That's Larry Cancro and I can just go on and on, marketing, advertising, and so forth. And then there's baseball ops. And Chaim Bloom's job is not to have State of Maine Day and Nun Day and Nuns Day and Mookie Betts Bobblehead Day and all that stuff. That's a whole different. His job is to put a winning team on the field. And I think if they win and they're exciting and they develop some exciting players, that solves a lot of their problems. But I'm in camp with you to the degree that as recently as the 1980s, 1986, when I think it was April 29th, April 30th, when Roger Clemens had the first 20 strikeout games, you can find that entire game on YouTube. I wrote about it a couple months ago. There were like 14,000 fans in the stands. And, you know, they would pack the place when the weather got warm and the races got interesting and so forth. But it wasn't that long ago that I'd be at Fenway for games and all of right there would be empty. And, yes, there is a chance that they could be returning on some nights to those days. Where I disagree with part of what you said, I never buy it when fans say, I'm done, I quit, it's over. Either because of Mookie Betts leaving or Cora's situation and all that. I think fans, casual fans may drift away, but they don't make bold pronouncements and act on them. I think the bigger problem, with the Red Sox will be growing their fan base and bringing in younger fans. That's it. If you're 50 years old.
Well, that's every team's problem.
Yeah, but if you're 50 years old and you've been watching the Red Sox since you were 7 years old, not a lot of those people are suddenly going to turn the game. I'm in my 60s, and obviously it's what I do for a living. I can comfortably say, because I get the MLB package, I watch Mets games and late-night Giants games. I like watching baseball. Now, there are parts of it that infuriate me now, but not to the degree that I'm going to turn the TV. I shall never watch a game again. I don't think a lot of people do that.
Yeah, I think I meant more in terms of, look, obviously people on Twitter are going to bluster and, you know, kind of just reply to everything the Red Sox tweet and be like, I'm no longer a fan, as if John Henry reads the Red Sox Twitter notifications. But I think more what I'm seeing is, you know, people saying like, well, I don't want to pay for Red Sox games. You know, I can't afford them anyway. You know, it's a problem, in my opinion, when in most years, a baseball season is 162 games plus a postseason if you're lucky. And people say they can't even afford to go to one game. And to me, that's the biggest thing I'm going to be curious about with the Red Sox is the way that they're going to show fans that they care about them at all is by drastically lowering ticket prices or making a ticket package for next year. Because, yeah, they lost money, but they're the third rich – well, now fourth because of Steve Cohen. They're the fourth richest ownership group in all of pro sports. Unlike most Americans, they could afford to shoulder the burden of the money that they lost this year. And there are going to be plenty of Boston Red Sox fans who just say, well, I can't afford it.
Tell that to all the Red Sox employees who were laid off toward the end of the season. So,
well, yeah, I know, but I'm saying that that too. You know, they laid off people. They didn't, you know, teams didn't want to pay minor leaguers $400 a week. The Mets cut 39 minor leaguers in May just to save $15,000 a week. Do you think that they're going to actually kind of make that gesture to the fans to be like, hey, we actually want you to be able to afford to come into the ballpark again?
I don't think they will, quote unquote, lower ticket prices. I think what they will do, and I suppose in terms of fancy bookkeeping, this will be a ticket price reduction. I think they will have more giveaways and more theme days and, you know, Cub Scout Day and just under 17 day. Yeah. I'm sort of making stuff up here. But what they've got to do is choose individual games where they, like when I was a kid, now I had kind of a special, I don't know if we talked about this, but my uncle was an usher at Fenway when I was a kid. And I got to go to all the free games I wanted because at the risk of having the Red Sox call me up and say, hey, you owe us $10,000 when you were a kid. I get into Fenway for free every time because I knew my uncle's buddy at Gate So-and-so and he knew who I was and I'd waltz in and then I'd hang
around.
Okay,
ticket prices were 5 cents back then. You're fine.
Yeah, and but they also had lots of like we had a school trip where we, you know, you'd sit out in section 3 for a game. You could look it up. I remember 1971 maybe or 70, Camille Pascual, I think it was his last major league start. I didn't know that at the time. I'm only saying this because I looked it up a while ago, but I remember a school trip where we all went to Fenway and sat out in right field. It was a weekday day game in April or early May or either 70 or 71. And we all, there was a bus. We went in, we all went in. We all sat there. There was no money. You know, it was like this. I don't know if the school system paid for it. And you look out, all right field was filled with school kids. And it was obviously something the Red Sox of that time had set up with various school systems throughout greater Boston. And it was a weekday day game early in the season. And it was they knew that, you know, it was called in theater, they call it papering the house. And that's what they did there. You pay for the house. You basically get people in there for free, just to fill the seats, make the ballpark look good. It's win-win all the way around because kids who go to the games for free in those circumstances might be inspired to come back later on. And if nothing else, we're all buying Cokes and hot dogs and other crap during the game.
That's my exact argument. People can't spend money in the ballpark if they can't afford to get into the ballpark.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm sure that they've got meetings going on this very moment where they're discussing the issues that we're discussing.
I spend too much time on Twitter and I just see how sad Red Sox fans have been. And it hurts me because I've been sad too. Obviously I've also been angry, but I've been sad. I think about how many games I went to as a kid because, you know, my mom's office had season tickets too. So that was never a consideration for me. But if I don't think that my parents would have taken me to multiple Fenway games every single year if it was something that was they would have had to pay for. And so I don't know if I would have been the person that I am today. I think about the kids that maybe their parents can't afford to take them, and then they're just not going to get to grow up loving baseball. That should be something baseball considers if they want to have a fruitful future in this country.
Well, and I said a minute ago that they're probably sitting in a room discussing this at this very moment. I might build on that by saying that perhaps it should be you in that room doing the PowerPoint presentation.
They probably wouldn't hire me at this point because I'd have to scrub my entire Twitter. But I would love to go into one of these offices and, you know, kind of be like a fan perspective representative and just be like, hi, do you realize, like, it's probably hard for them, you know, if you're in the organization for such a long time and you're not on the outside looking in, it's probably hard to kind of put yourself in the fans' shoes of being like, well, hey, if I want to drive to Fenway, I got to pay $50 for parking. I got to pay, you know, minimum $40 for a ticket plus ticket fees. And then I got to go into the ballpark and get, you know, a $6 water bottle, a $15 beer, a $14 lobster roll. You know, it's money. It's a luxury that most people don't have right now. They always say, you know, Red Sox fans are the best fans in baseball. All right. So, you know, show them that you love them. These are easy solutions with long-term growth benefits. The path forward is clear. It's just a matter of how much they care about doing it.
No, I agree. And, you know, it's funny. Somebody I know died a few years ago, and in that person's obituary in the newspapers, it mentioned lifelong Red Sox fan. And there was a picture of the person, you know, wearing a baseball cap. And I thought that was kind of cool. And then it was pointed out to me that you'd be surprised how often you see that. And so every once in a while, I would scan the obits, just run my finger down, looking for how many times, sorry, I thought about doing but never wrote, how many times a person's death notice mentions that he or she was a lifelong Red Sox fan, and how many times the person in the photo has a Red Sox cap on and so forth. Now, that's not something I remember when I was a kid, that somebody's death notice would include that said person was a Red Sox fan. Obits now are a lot more flowery. He or she enjoyed sailing and walking along the beach and spending time at the senior center and all these accoutrements to that person's life. So I get that, but it does speak to the larger issue that it's not unreasonable to worry that older fans of the Red Sox, the staid and true, tried and true lifelong Red Sox fan, is going to that big ballpark in the sky, and they're not being replaced by younger fans. That's something they should worry about.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think about, you know, in 2004, when they won the World Series and they reversed the curse, a lot of people went to visit, you know, parents or grandparents' headstones in cemeteries and put championship t-shirts on them, or Red Sox flags or caps, or like, you know, something. They went to go see family members who didn't live long enough to see it happen. Or all of the stories about people who were in the hospital just holding on to see them reverse the curse. You know, you heard those stories. They're in the World Series DVD. They were in the newspaper. You know, you were hearing about these people. They lived their entire life waiting to see if the Red Sox could win. I mean, I told you about my great uncle. He's 102 now. In 2004, he was 86 years old. He was born in June 1918. So he's slightly younger than you. His birthday is the week after mine. He loves Chris Sale. He's like the biggest Chris Sale fan. He thinks he's amazing. Like a year or so ago, I was on the phone with him. He said, you know, I never thought I would live to see a World Series that I remember, you know, being like 3 months old in 1918 when it happened. He said, and now I've seen four. But, you know, his younger brother, my dad's dad, died when my dad was 15. You know, they went to the 1967 World Series. They lost that one. He died a few years later. He never lived to see it happen. And I think that's another side of, you know, what you're talking about with the obituaries. Think about how many people visited their parents' graves in 2004 to hopefully pass on the message, and hopefully in some way those parents would know that the Red Sox did it. Like, that's the kind of thing that baseball in Boston, it has such a powerful intergenerational hold on people. And the Red Sox have that more than almost any other franchise because they've been around for such a long time. And I don't want them to lose that by, you know, pricing fans out, blacking them out, you know, all this kind of stuff. I want that for future Red Sox fans. I want that maybe for my own kids someday. I don't want to say to my kids, oh, you know, sorry, we can't afford to go to a game this season, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, that's what I'm thinking about lately.
I hear you, and I hope they listen to you.
They haven't before, but, you know, hope springs eternal. Anyway, Buck, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for like a million things, but thank you for coming on. Thank you for being such an amazing writer and person and mentor and friend. Tell people, you know, obviously they can read you on The Athletic, but tell people where they can find you on social media.
Oh, it's at Buck in Boston, and I'm on Facebook, and Twitter's a good place to find me, but you can also just go to theathletic.com, and I love writing for them, and they give me lots of leeway and freedom to try different things, and I really enjoy it. I'm humbled and flattered by your kind words. You know how much I admire you and love talking with you, and I hope we get to hang out real soon.
I know, me too. Thank you so much. That was such a treat getting to talk to Buck about all of that. I've known him for almost 4 years now. We actually met at the charity ball game that he puts on in Cambridge, Mass. Every single year. It's called the Old Time Game. And I wrote a piece about it in the early days of Girl at the Game. And Buck, without realizing that I was the person that he had met the night before, tweeted it out and said, "This is one of the best pieces ever written on the game." And the game has been going on for almost 30 years at this point. And we became friends. And now I help out with the game every year. Obviously, there was no Old Time Game this year in 2020, but I'm hopeful that next year we'll be back at it together. He is a wonderful writer and an even more incredible person. And I'm just so glad that he came on today and that you guys got to hear his perspective. He's been around the game forever, and he is just the smartest, most clever guy. So thank you to my dear friend, Buck. And you guys can follow him on social media at Buck in Boston, all one word. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at GFSTARR1. You can follow Locked On Red Sox at LO_Red Sox. Thanks so much for tuning in. Wear a mask. And as always, go Red Sox.